Kind of a conclusion from last week's lesson where I talked about the city there at Thessalonica, and we went over a review of the book of 1 Thessalonians. Book of 2 Thessalonians, a much shorter book, only three chapters, but there's quite a bit of information in there that's useful to us that we can apply to our learning and our studies that we do on our own, and can help answer some questions that maybe there's a lot of confusion about in the world. Now, you may recall last week when I was talking about Thessalonica that it was a city, it was a seaport in the region of Macedonia. It was head of at the Gulf. There's the port of Thessalonica is right there where the city is. Other towns that are nearby with which we are familiar, it is southwest of Philippi and Amphipolis, and wasn't too very far northeast of Berea. So these are all towns that we've heard before. Talked last week about it was a mixed city. There were a lot of Greeks, Romans, and there was a pretty considerable Jewish community there in that area. Now, I did a little more digging this week when I went into it. I mentioned last week that the town there is a town at the location where Thessalonica was, and that unlike some of the other epistles we studied and the towns that were associated with those churches, there really wasn't anything there. I understated it a bit last week. I got some more recent numbers, and there actually is a town. I think I mentioned last week the town is called Saloniki, but really that's a kind of a condensed version of Thessaloniki is how that town is referred to today. And there were, I mentioned last week there was about 70,000 people living there. Well, that was understating it by a little bit. It's actually considered the unofficial co-capital of the country of Greece. It's a very esteemed city. And there are 325,000 people living in the city. There are 824,000 people living in the suburban areas, and then if you think about just the greater metropolitan area, there's over 1 million people living in this area. So this is not a small city by today's standards. It is Greece's second major economic, industrial, commercial, and political center, and just like it was in the time of when the epistle was written, it very much still is a center of commerce. The port there at Thessaloniki does carry quite a bit of material goods and so forth, and it is known for that. There's a lot of festivals, and it is a rich cultural center in the country of Greece. So quite a bit different story than I painted last week as I looked into it. I was relying upon some outdated information. So interesting that it has continued where some of the other cities have not. Now, last week we talked about that based upon where Paul was and where also Silas and Timothy were at the writing of 1 Thessalonians, that it pointed towards Paul having written the epistle to the first epistle to the Thessalonians when he was in Corinth. Well, this epistle appears to be written fairly soon after the first epistle. And it does appear to have been from the same place, which was Corinth. The proof of this, we can't be 100% confident with, but there are no marks of time, there are no reference points in this that we can have any confidence in the timing and placing. The probability rests upon just some things we do learn in the epistle itself, and some of the people that are mentioned. In this case, Paul, Silas, and Timothy. They're mentioned in both epistles and are mentioned as being together at the time that they were written. Paul sending greetings and so forth like that, making mention. As Gary read, Silvanus and Silas and Timothy were there with him at the time they were written. There is reason to believe that they didn't stay together very long, the three of them, and so it's presumed that one was written right after the other, that there wasn't a whole lot of leeway there. Paul refers to an error which has come about since the writing of his first epistle. And that's really strongly the reason why the second letter had to be written. It was a misunderstanding of some terms in what Paul had told them in the first epistle. This was producing some anxiety there. There were people that were getting very uneasy based upon this misunderstanding or misinterpretation of what Paul had written to them. And so Paul was writing back to them to be able to correct that and to set the record straight. Now, I mentioned last week there wasn't even a Pony Express, that we know of. I mean, so time had to have passed a little bit for that letter to have been delivered, for that letter to have been written, for it gotten to the point where people were anxious, and then for it to get back to Paul. I mean, so when I say there's not a lot of time, I mean, we're still probably talking several months between the writings of this of these two epistles. Now, another thing that we can kind of time or put in place in a timeline was that it is evident from the epistle itself that it was written before the troubles came upon Paul when he was at Corinth. Just the timing worked out very nicely. What we talked about last week, that John, when he was talking about the class, we talked about that judge or that magistrate, Gallio. Well, it's thought that that passage in Acts happened after Paul wrote this second letter. Paul seemed to know that there was some trouble coming up, and he makes mention of it in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Finally, brothers, pray for us that the word of the Lord may speed ahead and be honored, as happened among you, and that we may be delivered from wicked and evil men, for not all have faith. So that lends us to think that while he was there at Corinth, he knew there was trouble brewing, very possibly the same trouble that we talked about last Sunday morning. So because of this, it would seem that this might have only written a few months after the first epistle, and that would put it towards probably around 53 to maybe the very beginning of 54 AD. Now we get into the reason why it was written. There's very little doubt about why it had to be written, mostly, like I said, because of this false interpretation of what Paul had written to them in the first epistle, or Paul alludes to maybe an epistle that was written by someone else that had Paul's name on it. Someone was passing off an epistle and saying it was written by Paul. What this error was that the Lord was going to be returning, and be returning very, very soon. That it wasn't, that it was imminent, that at any moment the Lord could return. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, this is where Paul addresses this. Now concerning the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ, and our being gathered together to him, we ask you, brothers, not to be quickly shaken in mind or alarmed, either by a spirit or a spoken word or a letter seeming to be from us, to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. Not only were they thinking it was imminent, they were thinking that they've missed it. So there was anxiety that they have been faithful, that they were doing what they needed to do. And so correcting this error was the main reason for Paul writing this very short letter. Like I said, there was a lot of anxiety, people had become alarmed, and it was all unnecessary, and Paul needed to correct that. And it got to the point where some people were saying, well, I don't need to work. The Lord's going to be coming any minute now. What? We've seen that some of these people who have predicted the end of the world, and they sell everything and they go on a grand vacation. They live it up waiting for the Lord to return. Well, that sentiment here is at play here, it seems. They don't see the need to work. Well, the Lord's going to be coming back any day now. I don't need to prepare for my future. And so Paul took upon himself to write this letter and introduce a select other few topics for their consideration. And even though it's very short, it has a lot of permanent value. And for anyone who wants to have a deeper understanding or a correct understanding of how the Lord will be returning and what we have to expect, it has great value in that. So history has shown that they were not the only ones who were struggling with this concept. Lots of different theories out today about people predicting when the Lord will come back, as I mentioned, or just what's going to happen when the Lord returns. There is still confusion today, and this epistle, even though is on the record from an inspired writer and plainly spells out what's going to happen, there are people that to this day seem to not be paying attention to it and be thinking of things other than what Paul said here. So, but basically the epistle is important because Paul is saying that he did not believe and he did not mean to teach to them that the Lord, the end of the world and the Lord's coming was very near. So this is also an attempt, like I said, these people that even today try to predict the end of the world, this was here to counteract that, to go against those people that were trying to pick a day. The declaration of the scriptures are very clear here. There's quite a few of them, and the fact of the matter is we're not told any clues or anything that we can apply to our lives to know when it was going to be happening. And so the truth is God does not expect us to be able to figure it out. If it was so easily done that we could live our lives the way we want, hoping that we don't die by an accident or an illness along the way, and the Lord's going to be coming back, well, he's not coming back in my lifetime. Do I need? So obviously the idea is that we need to be prepared, and if we knew when it was coming, we would not be living like we should, or quite a few of us would not be. So with all that in mind, I want to do an overview of the three chapters and introduce what is covered in the book. Now, Gary read for us the first two verses along with the third and fourth, and the first two verses of chapter one are just a salutation that Paul wrote to the members there at Thessalonica, greeting them. In verses 3 and 4, he expresses his thanks for the progress which they had made in their devotion and in their faith to the Lord, especially in the way they handled themselves when trials came about. He was very complimentary of them. Going back to last week, this was not a situation from some of the other epistles that it wasn't clear from the writing that Paul, you know, was not familiar with this church firsthand. In the first epistle, Paul wrote to them saying many times he wanted to come see them. He ached to meet with them again, but was not, you know, situations didn't allow itself. He needed to be where he was or whatever the case may be. That passes through to this epistle. It's very clear that he is familiar with the church and the members there at Thessalonica. Verse 5 contains an assurance that the manner in which they had been enabled to bear their trials was some evidence that they were living a faithful life, that they were being tested because they stood out among others in their area. And it was evidence that their Christian life was working. Verses 6 through 10 of chapter 1, this contains a declaration to those who had persecuted them, and there would be a punishment that would be coming upon them when the Lord should come, and that when this would occur, the righteous would appear in glory and honor with him, and not those who had been persecuting the members there at Thessalonica. And the chapter ends, verses 11 and 12, the expression of an earnest desire that they may be prepared for that day. When the Lord coming, they needed to be prepared. And that when the Lord came, his desire was that they would be found worthy and they would be glorified when that event took place. Then as we get into chapter 2, the first two verses contain an exhortation that they would not be alarmed or distressed by the expectation of the Lord coming. I read that earlier, that nothing that he had written, and if there was a letter going around saying it was from him, that was not, he was saying that isn't something that I wrote, that you should not be getting all worked up. And so verses 3 through 12 then give a statement of the truth that he would not soon appear, and of the characteristics of, depending upon the translations you're reading, it might say an apostasy, it might say a falling away. I know the English Standard says a rebellion. This is, there's a lot of different thoughts on what these verses here mean. And I'm not intending in the remaining time that I have this morning to go into much detail on it. I did do a bit of research into it and have some thoughts about who this person is or what the situation is. But for lack of, just to keep it consistent, I'm going to just call it the apostasy that is mentioned here in chapter 2. That this apostasy must take place before his return, and this is what Paul is referencing here as we go on. In this part of the chapter, Paul begins to show that he did not mean to teach that the return of the Lord was soon, and because he says this apostasy needs to take place before it can even happen, and that it hasn't happened yet, and it's going to take a little bit of time for this to occur. And so, at least for that point in time, the people that were alive and were reading that letter did have some assurance that the Lord was not going to be coming during their lifetime, most likely. Now, he still was encouraging them to stay faithful, as he should, but it was not something that they would have to be too concerned about. And like verse 3 talked about this great apostasy and a revelation of the man of sin, and I know different versions say that a little bit differently, but this man of sin was really what we can gather is that we're told this man of sin, that he would be opposed to God, he would exalt himself above all that is called God, above all that is called God, and he would sit in the temple showing himself as God. Now, read some articles, read some people's thoughts on who this man of sin was, and some people think it was the Roman armies that came in to destroy Jerusalem. Some people think it's the devil himself, but once again, I didn't spend a whole lot of time, and if I was doing a full sermon on this, it would be something I would go a little further into, but it does seem that it does kind of play into the papal system, the Pope. It does fit some of this characteristics but the Pope typically isn't opposed to God, but his activities are actually opposed to God. I talked the last three times I've had the main sermon, I talked about the seven things that the Lord hates, and if you're doing any of those, you are opposing yourself to God. So if you look at it that way, the Roman Church is taking things and has added and has become opposition to God. The Pope certainly calls himself God on earth, you know, that's the thought. And sitting in a temple showing himself as God, well, that kind of fits. Once again, please do this research on your own. This is not a definitive answer. Believe me, people have been debating this for centuries. I'm not going to figure it out in one afternoon with a little bit of research for this talk. So please, please do take that time if that's something in which you have interest. So, but in verses 5 through 7, Paul says there has been a great restraint placed on this man of sin that is prevented the apostasy from happening so far, and that God would restrain them for still a bit longer, and then he would allow the man of sin to be revealed. Verses 8 through 12 then says, the Lord's coming would be after the activity of Satan, with powers and signs and lying wonders, and under him there would be a strong delusion, and it says the belief of a lie. The great foe of God was going to be destroyed, though, when the Lord came. That is one reason why a lot of people think it's not the Roman army, because the Lord hasn't come, but yet they were already destroyed. And so that is probably not an account of who this person was or what it represents. Then verses 13 and 14, Paul tells them that there was an occasion for thankfulness to God, that he had chosen them to salvation and not left them to be destroyed. And then chapter 2 ends with an exhortation to stand fast in verses 15 through 17. It tells them to maintain what they had been taught, and a prayer to God who had given them of hope who had given them a good hope would comfort their hearts. And then the last chapter, chapter 3, the apostle begins by asking for their prayers. He desired them to pray, particularly that the word of the Lord would be successfully spread, but then also that those that were going to be troubling him, that he would be able to be delivered from them. That's the reference I mentioned earlier about when he went before Gallio, most likely. Verses 3 through 5, he expresses confidence that God would direct them to do what was right, that they were able to lean on him, and that would allow them to do what they needed to do. And he prays that he would keep their hearts in his love. Verses 6 through 12, he commands them to remove those who were disorderly, especially those who were idle, the ones that were not working. That he commanded and encouraged these people to work and to earn their own living, and that they were to be doing it in a way that was respectful, and but then to encourage them to live their life as if the Lord wasn't returning, to support themselves and provide for themselves. Verse 13, he exhorts them for not being too weary in doing well, that they were holding up, they were continuing, they were not losing any steam, that they were continuing to being faithful. Verses 14 and 15, he directs that if anyone should not obey the commands given in this epistle, he should be noted, and they were to separate themselves from them. So he says, so when they were separated, that they would be ashamed that this had to happen to them, and that they would be aware of the issue. But they were not to regard him as an enemy, but to still consider them, but yet admonish them as a fellow brother. And then the last three verses, 16 through 18, the epistle closes with usual salutations and greetings that typically happen at the end of a letter that Paul wrote. So, several things that were here specifically written to the Thessalonians, but every bit of it is something that we can apply to today. Like I said, there's no shortage of people still questioning or having different perceptions of what the return of the Lord is going to, when it's going to happen and what it's going to result in when it occurred. Brother Tommy has the prayer, and we will ask him to come forward and lead that prayer, and we will be dismissed to our class.